and welcome to Just Plain Wrong, the podcast where three Mennonite librarians discuss depictions of Amish, Mennonites, and other plain groups in popular culture. I'm Abby Nafziger, your moderator for this episode, and with me are my co-hosts, Aaron Milanese and Tilly Yoder. This episode, we will be discussing When the English Fall by David Williams, a post-apocalyptic Amish novel published in 2017. And for longtime listeners, you may remember that this was actually recommended to us way back in season one by Valerie Beaver Zerker when she came on an episode to talk about her book. She recommended this one. So we finally got around to it. So for our opener question, given this is a post-apocalyptic novel, and a lot of it kind of revolves around this theme of how the Amish are in some ways better prepared for this type of disaster, which got me thinking about how much of a prepper are you? The alternate title, how screwed would you be if you lost all electricity for a long-term or permanent basis? So, Tilly, why don't you start us off?
Oh, I am not much of a prepper. I pay attention to the weather. So if we're supposed to get a winter storm, then I'll go and pick up toilet paper and water and stuff. And I generally try and keep my pantry stocked with things that I could eat for a long time. But some of that's just cooking laziness, not necessarily foresight. I like to think that I would be okay for a little while without electricity. I've gone several days without it. And I know what some of the workarounds look like, but I'd be dead in the first wave if whatever apocalypse happens. I like my creature comforts. And probably the best thing I could say about myself is that if the universe just happened to make me lucky, I think that I could sell librarianship as a useful enough skill without access to the internet that other people might be willing to feed me. I have a handful of farming knowledge, which may or may not be useless depending on what you need to farm. And I can tell you how to organize some old knowledge. That's about all I can hope for. I
watched about half of The Mummy last night, and that librarian is incredibly valuable to her extenuating circumstances.
She is. The Mummy is delightful.
It's interesting because I feel like all my librarian skills would really revolve. So much of what I do is finding stuff for people on the internet. Mm-hmm. So I just feel like if that went away, I could alphabetize some books on a shelf for you, but unless I'm going to recreate a card catalog by hand,
it'd have to be about knowledge recovery and organization. It'd be I will hold down the fort at this library and guard it and distribute it to you. And and then also I just so happen to have a lot of weird niche interests that I have pursued in an ADHD sort of way. And so maybe some of those things will come in handy.
Yeah. We'll be the rock stars of the post-apocalyptic trivia team. Yes.
What would happen to her trivia if you don't have the internet to prove things anymore?
Find actual reference books. Someone somewhere has an Encyclopedia Britannica, a full set, in their garage, from maybe as late as 2000, that would just all of our knowledge would just reset to that point.
Well, actually many, many people, I'm pretty sure my parents have a that world book thing that would come out. I'm pretty sure they still have theirs. So, that's our new internet sitting on the shelves at my parents' house.
This is reminding me of my favorite post-apocalyptic book is Station 11, probably. And it's all because it's about an acting troupe and they take the Star Trek phase. What is it? Survival is insufficient. I'm like, yes, that's good. That's me after the apocalypse, ideally, because I don't have the tools for survival, but I have hopefully have some of the tools to make survival more interesting.
How about you, Aaron? How prepared are you?
So yeah, like Tilly, I am not much of a prepper, but that is partly because I currently live in a 700-ish square foot apartment. So there's not a ton of room. We are Costco members, though. So, you know, we could probably survive a week as long as the water was still drinkable. We have cans of beans and stuff. But yeah, as far as the context laid out in the book, we would be out of food within probably 10 days. And if there was no electricity, couldn't cook half of what we had anyway. We do still own and know how to use an old-fashioned can opener. I don't know that all the youngins of today know.
So you could access your own, like, shelf-stable food.
I could open my own can of beans. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So not much of one, maybe when we have a house again, but I've never been into canning or any of those sorts of activities that would lead to mm-hmm. more foods on hand. But I like Tilly's optimistic attitude towards our profession surviving the apocalypse. I'm not sure I share it, but I appreciate it.
Well, I'm thinking of all the wonderful books that the MHL has, not only about Amish Mennonite life, but handy things about like how to can and when to plant and how to do it by hand. And like, actually, if crazy things were to go down right now and we were stuck in our geographic location, like MHL's new headquarters, like that's where I would hold up there.
Yeah, basically, I feel like I would be worthless during the apocalypse. Like, I don't think my chances of survival would be particularly high. But if I did somehow get through the apocalypse part, I think I could be okay at the post part, like where the survivors kind of look around and go like, okay, how are we going to figure out how to do things like live without electricity and, you know, grow our own food and can and that kind of stuff. But I don't think my path to get there would be very successful. All right. So the book, When the English Fall, takes the form of a found diary written by an Amish man in Pennsylvania whose entries cover an almost 3-month period during which some kind of solar storm destroys essentially all electrical objects. Jacob lives with his wife, Hannah, and 2 children on a 48-acre farm in an Amish district near Lancaster. Sadie, the oldest, has seizures and some kind of mental illness. However, she is also known for her ability to foretell future events. During opening entries, Jacob is very worried about Sadie, who has been experiencing an increase in seizures and keeps ranting about angel wings and the English fall. Eventually, the event Sadie predicted occurs and a Carrington event takes place, which is an immense blast of charged particles from the sun, which causes aurora borealis to be visible across the continental U.S. and devastates the electrical grid. Jacob and his family are mostly unaffected by the event. However, they quickly begin to hear from the English world about the devastation the event causes. Jacob and his family are lucky in that they have extensive non-perishable supplies and a meat drying building for Jacob to make jerky with. The local Amish community donates food to the National Guard and tries to care for their English neighbors. Jacob and his family take in Mike, an Englishman, who is the dealer for Jacob's custom-made furniture business and his family. However, as the fall continues and winter approaches, violence and crowds of starving people impact the Amish. This comes to a head when a nearby Amish family is murdered and their home sacked by a band of armed men. The local English town members come to the Amish community's defense and kill most of the band in a shootout. However, 2 members of the original group escape and confront Jacob and his family. They are about to shoot Jacob and his family when Mike's son shoots them. These events cause the Amish community to leave their community and head west to Ohio. They don't want to compromise their faith by relying on others around them to take up arms in their defense. As they prepare to leave, Jacob decides to start a new volume of his diary and leave all of the current volumes behind in order to help him move on from the traumatic events, hence this, you know, the ending where it ends and being found kind of after events. So to start us off, let's look at what were the things about this book that stood out to you as accurate or inaccurate?
I thought that a lot of the day-to-day life seemed thoughtful and felt real. I think the it was a good balance between having Jacob as a character really think about his actions and the morality and the intent behind them, and also do some things without thinking because they're habitual and you don't always need to think about why God wants you to live the way you do when you're just feeding the pigs every morning. That being said, there were a few things that were kind of weird. Some of the prayers just felt a bit more evangelical, and there were a few references to things that didn't seem right, like referring to Sunday church services as the Sabbath. And I also, because all the entries are dated, noticed that church Sundays happened every week and not every other week, which is standard. But then there's a line later in the book where Jacob says, like, this isn't normal times, and normally we only have church services every other week. So I guess that is explained. Other things that would normally be kind of unusual or read as atypical, like Jacob's small family, are explained because they had trouble conceiving. They have a child with health problems, you know, and then also it becomes clear that Jacob moved from a different district, maybe in Ohio, something to do with tension with his father and his uncle, and just decided to kind of make a clean break. And it's clear that the Ordnung where he had come from was much stricter and he felt more oppressive, so he had shifted. And that also explains why there weren't, like, he had a big network, but not, the network wasn't family. So I thought that was a reasonable reason to have a small family, a believable reason. Yeah, the daily life, I think, seemed well thought out. It was like, oh, none of us can have freezers, but we're allowed to have a freezer in common as a community. Or there are small generators and motors that we can use for certain tasks. Or I can use my English friend to help me sell my furniture, but I won't do it directly myself. It was a good awareness of how networked Amish communities are, because they have to be.
Yeah. So yeah, this was an interesting book because it was written so differently than the Amish romance we read. There was a lot in this book about choosing pastors, and like Tilly mentioned, that sometimes stemmed with them sharing how people were selected in other communities. But they go through the whole lot process. And in fact, Jacob, towards the end of the book, is actually selected to be one of the new preachers, a role he does not want, which frankly also felt rather realistic. That when you're given this rather big task by chance, it would feel like a gift and a burden at the same time. I also had a lot of questions about things. So one of the themes throughout the book is Jacob's doing this journaling, and he clearly feels guilty about it. I don't know how many times he mentions, like, he had to get, like, special exception from the bishop to journal because it helps with his anxiety, and he just feels this, like, need to do it, but he's not supposed to do it because it causes pride, which feels like it could be accurate, but also I'm not sure it is. Like, I don't know of any prohibitions against journaling. And my great grandma was an avid journaler. She had left us boxes of journals, and she was Amish until middle age. I'm not sure how many of those journals came from when she was still Amish, though. So did you have
I have a thought on that, which is that I was lumping in his shame and fear, all the kind of strong emotions he was attaching to journaling, as a holdover from his last community. And we do know that he had a father who was very much like, reading is a no, writing is a no, anything that isn't work is no. And so in my mind, it was like, oh, it's a thing that, you know, of course he should be able to do, but he can't uncouple it from what he was taught as a child.
Yeah, I like that interpretation. Yeah, that makes more sense to me. There's also this detail, I think this was mentioned at least twice, maybe more, that like sometimes he can't sleep. And so when he can't sleep, he gets out the martyr's mirror and starts reading stories of martyrs to relax. And It is true that most Amish people, many Mennonites as well, have a copy of that book in their homes, but I can't imagine it being the book. Like, if he had been picking up the Bible and reading that, I would have not even marked that in my reading as I would have glossed right over that. But mm-hmm. like to pick up the Martyr's Mirror and read that for fun. Yeah, that's a choice. And then I know we all had thoughts on the names, which were kind of like variations on Amish names. So like one that stuck out was instead of Stoltzfus, it was Stoltzfutz, like ended with a Z. And I took that. I didn't necessarily think that was an inaccuracy. I just immediately was like, oh, this must take place in the future and names have changed. But yeah, mm-hmm. curious if that was the same interpretation you both had.
Yeah, when I read it, I kind of interpreted it as the future, but like the near future. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I definitely thought that was maybe a little bit further along. Like it the way they talked about climate change and the impact, like throughout this mm-hmm. fall, even before the event, they kept talking about how unseasonably warm it was and how that mm-hmm. was impacting their farming. But also like threads that happening today, like they talk about Mike, the English man who does the furniture selling for Jacob, is very angry and listens to talk radio and has a lot of opinions that Jacob just kind mm-hmm. of nods and, you know, whatever. Yeah. And some of these ideas of like the glimpses you see of the English world seemed like maybe slightly in the future, but very connected to this time. So I think when I was reading it, I just was like, would have put it in the like 5-10 years maybe in the future, as opposed to more distant future. But
that's about where I put it. Maybe a little further down the line when climate changes will be more regularly felt in North America. Mm-hmm. The names, I sort of shrugged. It's like the Stoltzfus thing, I kept in my head, I couldn't pronounce it. It's like Stolfutz.
Well, that's right. It is missing.
Is how it's spelled. Well, I guess that could be a variation. I didn't take the time to look up any spellings in the dictionary in a directory. But then there was like all this like Nordic influencing, like Sorensen and Michelson or Mikkelsen, and I was like, well, maybe there's just an influence of converts mm-hmm. from Sweden.
Well, and those were Amish families with those names, not like. Yeah. English communities.
Yeah, like I English think the bishop was a Sorensen. Definitely one of the sins.
Sins. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think I think I just glossed over the names. I wasn't. Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, I think you guys hit a lot of the big ones for accuracies and inaccuracies. Well, I don't know if this is accuracy or inaccuracy, but I liked the way that Jacob portrayed his relationship with his wife Hannah. It felt like it was clear that they were very, like, they relied on each other and they were very connected, but they also, it didn't feel like they were super lovey-dovey, but this, I don't know, they had this, like, calm togetherness and appreciation for each other, even during these really rough events they'd had. Like, in many ways, like, they, like, even in the opening when they're, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, with their older, like, the pretty severe seizures and mental illness that their daughter Sadie is experiencing, like, that is a really big impact on them and their relationship, but the way that they portrayed it. Yeah. I just really appreciated that. I don't know if that was accuracy or inaccuracy, but I thought it was well done.
Yeah. I'm glad you highlighted that. I also recall thinking that like they were a compatible family. Mm-hmm. That was clearly used to working together and making decisions together. And there were certainly some more set roles within it, but it was genuine emotion without being like insta-love, which I guess in yeah. some ways makes sense. Maybe they had insta-love back in Ohio, but you know, now they've got two children who are teenagers yeah. and you know, they've mellowed and the relationship just seemed sweet.
Yes. Yeah.
In a way that I liked. In contrast mm-hmm. to the like syrupy sweetness of we're just now falling in love narratives we usually get.
Exactly. And I also just like, I was impressed. They portrayed a depth of relationship without a huge amount of time spent discussing it. Because mm-hmm. like this is Jacob's diary. He doesn't spend long passages going, oh, I love my wife and blah, blah, blah. And this is how we interact. He's just like relating the way he relates a few details here and there just conveyed it very well. I don't know where this fits in here, but I'm going to talk about it. I struggled a little bit. Jacob felt like such a, I couldn't quite figure out if he was almost too righteous. There was an element of so much of the way that he was approaching things. And it made me kind of go down the path of like, is this, you know, this was written by, I think, like a Methodist preacher or something. Is this, is Jacob portraying kind of the Amish as perfection, you know, the idea that they would never do any wrong and they always make good decisions. But I also thought about it some more, and I think it didn't feel like it was stereotyped. It felt like, in part also, like he was just a really decent person, and he wasn't necessarily always making the right decision, but in part, like also it's the fact that you're reading his diary. So the way that these, you're getting all his perspective. So it makes it a little harder, like to be a flawed character in your own diary. So I kind of backed away from that and saw it more just like, this was just a very decent person who happened to be Amish, as opposed to all Amish are perfect, if that makes sense. Yeah. So moving into our next question, Sadie, so the oldest child of Jacob and Hannah, is a interesting character in that she is implied to have been diagnosed with schizophrenia, but after the apocalypse, which she has been kind of fixated on and predicting and foretelling, she seems mostly cured for almost a month before getting another seizure and then requiring more seizure medicine. Also, the Amish community seems to embrace her ability to tell the future, or at least they do after the English fall, her big prediction that turns out to be accurate. And after that, they seem to kind of view her as a prophet, and they actually, it's her urging and her kind of talking about how she thinks they should leave their current area and travel to Ohio. It's taken very seriously and just kind of seen as like, oh yeah, we should probably do this. So I don't know. They had a lot kind of going on here about like, how did you feel about this portrayal of Amish people or mental illness or prophetic visions, I guess? I guess I'll start us off here. I kind of went back and forth. At various points in the book, I was a little concerned at first where they were connecting like mental illness with like the ability to like foretell the future. And then this, especially this kind of like point where she kind of gets cured through something. But there was this interesting choice then to have her, like the seizures do come back. Like she isn't just fine. She isn't just like waiting for this big event to happen. And then, oh, there goes all of her, her mental illness and her seizures and everything. So I thought it was kind of, I don't know, surprisingly nuanced. It was also interesting in that it felt like most of the rest of the novel was pretty straightforward, kind of very realistic, but yet there's this like, okay, so this Amish girl seems to have some clue about the future and is viewed as having that by her community. And it's viewed as just kind of like, yeah, that's something to take advantage of. We should listen to her, as opposed to like, we should burn the witch. Like, it was kind of interesting. Like, yeah. So I ended up kind of feeling like it was in kind of a nuanced perspective on it. I think the part that I was in some ways the most uncertain about was how her suggestion that they leave ended up carrying so much weight. I mean, I do get it. There is an element, like this huge disaster that this young girl predicted was going to happen, happens. And then she says you should do something else. I could see all of a sudden that combating things like ages, you know, like she's young, therefore we shouldn't listen to her. She's a woman, therefore we shouldn't listen to her. Therefore she's mentally ill, so we shouldn't listen to her. Like, I could see you're in a whole new world of very different, you know, your sources of knowledge are much different. So maybe all of a sudden you'd be like, even if your community tends to be like, well, we only listen to men, maybe this would cause you to be like, well, maybe there's a point here. But yeah, it was interesting. I found the portrayal fascinating. I'm interested to hear what you all think as well.
I mean, I would follow the child that successfully predicted one major disaster.
Yeah.
No, I agree. It was interesting. What's interesting to hear you talk about, though, is, and I think this shows the type of dystopian post-apocalyptic books I typically read, which would be more in the YA camp. So much more optimism, much more things get better. And I'll talk about that more when we get to in later questions. But I actually thought she was going to be better. I thought that she was going to be cured and they were going to discover she never had a mental illness all along, that whatever was going on was like some sort of divine intervention or some way of warning the Amish that this was happening. So that was where I thought the story was going. And so when she sort of had her relapse, I was like, oh, I didn't expect that, because in the books I read, we would not have had that happen.
Well, you thought she was the chosen one, like the special person who like the rules don't apply to, who has the big event and everything changes.
Eventually a young Amish boy from another community would come and they would fall in love and everyone would be saved and the world would be fixed. Spoiler alert, that is not what happened.
All it takes is a couple of young teenagers in a love triangle to fix natural disaster, totalitarian regimes, you know, fascism, all these things taken Always. Down by lovelorn teenagers.
So that was where, like, I feel like I was so distracted by like that expectation that I didn't even really think a whole lot about the mental illness portrayal until you asked this question. So I guess I could leave my thoughts at that, but I guess I generally thought I appreciated the family's love and acceptance of her, sort of even through their skepticism and their refusal to send her away. And all of that was touching, at least. So yeah, I felt okay about it, but was then surprised by how it played out in the book.
I felt pretty good about the portrayal of Sadie, and I was nervous that it was going to be a scenario of like, your illness was a gift the whole time and now you've been magically cured because of faith in God or something.
See, that's what I thought was going to happen, Sally.
I know. And I was afraid it was going to happen because I don't like that narrative.
that is fair. Like, yeah.
But, yes. You know, like, not that I want people to have seizures, but when she had a seizure again, I was like, oh, thank God it's not pretending mental illness doesn't exist. Or, you know, nervous system illnesses, whatever the seizures are caused by. Yeah, and I think a lot of why I was so okay with her seizure visions being a plot device was because the focus for the vast majority of the book was always on her health. Like, the book starts off with Jacob saying that he's staying up late to watch over Sadie, and that he and his wife Hannah take turns doing that because they always want to know she's okay. And he's always writing about how she's doing each day. Was she more animated? Could she help in the kitchen? Was she bedridden? He wants her to be happy as much as she can be. He wants her to be healthy as much as she can be. They've clearly sought medical treatment for her. And when she kind of has these prophesying moments, initially everyone is skeptical. Like, they say, oh, she was born with like a caul over her face, which is like the sign of a seer or a prophet. And he just says, like, that's nonsense. She's been muttering about these things, but, you know, they seem to give her some comfort. So we sort of just accept them at face value and nod and continue. And, you know, it's not like we can do anything about them. And then when it becomes clear that there is a definite connection between the things she is saying and the events happening in the world around them, it's still taken with a grain of salt. Like, it's still like, these are vague enough pronouncements that she is making. These are not like lottery numbers. She's seeing visions of, this is like, the English are going to fall. There's going to be angels in the sky, but it'll all be okay. You know, like, you can't actually do much with that. And so the fact that I was a little perplexed as to why the community was so willing to be like, well, I guess we need direction. And if you feel strongly about this, you were right before. So, you know, it's one more sign in favor of leaving.
Don't you think she was also just like, they were probably all feeling it already. And so then to have this quote unquote prophet say the thing out loud.
Mm-hmm. It was validating probably.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or something they could point to and say, yeah.
Yes. The sign we've been looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, and her illness didn't go away, and Jacob and Hannah's concern for her never really went away. You know, it was enough of a distinction between like, oh, well, that's accurate and we don't really know how, but also like, well, she still, you know, needs medicine if we can get it for her.
Yeah. So. I think to kind of play off what you were saying, your response kind of clarified something for me, because I think so much of it matters less about the details of exactly what happens with Sadie, but the perspective of her, because this is always from Jacob's perspective. And like you said, Jacob cares about Sadie. Jacob wants her happy. Jacob wants her healthy. Jacob is like cares for her. So there is very little of this idea of kind of like, what can we extract from the mentally ill person to gain favor or whatever. It's very much like Sadie, her, like the viewpoint, how you see Sadie is always through these eyes, which are focused on care and health and, you know, that perspective.
I think it helps too that she's never really diagnosed with anything. Like they sort of hint at stuff that seems like it could be schizophrenia,
mm-hmm.
but you know, they've seen a doctor, but you also know that there's limited things for them to try. And so I appreciated that it was sort of like we're doing what we can, but we're not going to explicitly draw a line between like, you have multiple personality disorder, which means that's the reason you could see the future. Like, right. Let's not draw that connection.
Yeah. Yeah. So. All right. So for our next question, as we were kind of hinting, we want to talk a little bit about the ending of this book. So the author sets up some interesting choices for the Amish. Essentially at the end, what the community has to figure out is, do they take on great personal risk by doing this migration to Ohio? And essentially they're moving further away from the refugees and kind of the violence connected to that, that is coming out of Lancaster and a lot of the other East Coast cities, and also lose the chance to help those people by becoming refugees themselves. But, or do they stay where they are, where they can potentially help people more, but allow their English neighbors to defend them, which is clear that that's going to have to, like, for them to stay in Lancaster, they either have to accept being killed by people who, you know, starving people with guns. Yeah, so that's kind of the decision they're faced with. How do you feel about that decision? How do you feel about the choices they made?
Yeah, the ending. So first, this book gets bleak real fast in a way that is possibly realistic, but just a real pessimistic view of humanity and how quickly humans would shift into anarchy and violence, and like versus like community. Like, it definitely doesn't have the perspective that if food and electricity were scarce, that humans would help each other. It definitely shifts into each for his own, and people with the guns will rise to the top. So the Amish do manage to stay mostly safe. I don't know. It's dark in the book. I found it very dark. But at the same time, the tension that the Amish community was wrestling with did feel really realistic. Like, are we going to compromise our values and allow people to defend us with weapons and in ways we don't approve of? Or are we going to are we going to leave and risk that? I am not sure if they made the right choice, because I'm not convinced that Ohio, if the picture of humanity that is being painted in this book is how the author, like, I don't know. I guess I just don't think it would have been any better in Ohio. Ohio is not that much more rural than where they were at in Pennsylvania. And that was sort of what they were implying as well. By the time we get to Ohio, we'll be further out in the country and they won't be able, like, we'll be able to rebuild our own community more. Like, I feel like you need to keep on going. Like, you got to get to Wyoming to, to get that remote. Yeah. So that was sort of my general feelings. And I also just felt like it ended really abruptly. Not that I want to read a sequel, but got to the end. And like, it literally just ends with them the day they leave. He leaves his journal behind. And I was kind of mad because I was like, at least tell me you made it somewhere safely. But again, I don't usually read this genre. If I'm going to read books in this genre, they are YA and just very different sorts of worldviews and outcomes. So,
well, don't worry. Sadie predicted that it'll all turn out fine.
That is true, which I suppose should give me some hope. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one thing I will say about that, she predicted, like, she has this conversation, I think it's with Jacob at some point, where she basically says, if we stay here, some of us will die and some of us will live, but we'll have made these decisions. If we go, some of us will live and some of us will die. So it wasn't that everything will be okay and everyone will magically be able to, you know, migrate 2 weeks through apocalyptic landscape and make it safely to mean Ohio.
Ohio isn't the promised land.
But I mean, it does. She seemed to be pointing to this idea that they wouldn't like get to Ohio and immediately get completely wiped out by some roving band of whatever. But the idea that they would face violence and difficulty and death along the way, she seemed to be saying more that like it, the choice mattered and, you know, what was going to like, bad things will continue to happen, but good things will also continue to happen regardless of which way you go.
I should add that I was, to reiterate, I was thrilled they chose to listen to Sadie, a woman or a young girl, teen girl, in making this decision. But I just, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it was the right decision because the book ends before we know the outcome of the decision.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Tilly?
I thought that it was a very realistic dilemma for them to face. There's lots of precedents for Anabaptist groups moving to avoid things like military conscription, violence, persecution, you know, even just bad weather, political unrest. So getting up and leaving and trying to go someplace where you won't be drawn in by the world is entirely realistic. But the moral struggle of staying is a real one too, because Amish and Mennonite groups have aid organizations. It's acting out faith. And in this area, it's pretty clear that the Amish are the most well-equipped to deal with this situation. They have the best food stores, they have shelter, they have the knowledge of how to plant without planters that need tractors. They are there as unresisting victims in a way, or that they could be seen that way. So they have the power to be very hurt, or they have the power to help a lot, but they also have the possibility of being hurt very much. And yeah, I don't know if I think moving was the right decision. I think being complicit with violence, like especially the fact that they don't ask their English neighbors to pursue the roving band that has killed one Amish family, they know that they'll be complicit in violence.
Well, they probably feel like they already are. I mean, I would assume Jacob feels that way after some of the things that happen that he witnesses.
I felt that way for him, even if he didn't.
Yeah.
Have a, what, the kid was like 12 or 13.
That was an awful scene.
The gun that Jacob had for slaughtering animals and used it. I thought, that seems quite realistic. And still heartbreaking. Yeah. Also, the stuff about guns was noted throughout the narrative because Mike was always talking about the talk radio and people in the city, which I assumed was Philadelphia. You know, there were all these theories about how this event the solar flare was faked. It was by the government. They're coming for our guns. Yeah, I had to roll my eyes, but I was also like, yeah, people will believe that. Mm. And if they don't have access to the internet or news or anything, and you're just sitting around on your own, letting conspiracy theories multiply in your head, yeah, you'd get people who believe that. Mm-hmm. I guess the last thought I had, I didn't actually think of it as quite so bleak as I think you did, Aaron. Mm-hmm. I definitely could see that times were going to get harder, but the fact that it started off with people volunteering food and volunteering to help distribute it, and, you know, it was clear that the English might be doing their own hoarding and looting and stuff, but there was also clear that there were still forces in place, even if it was like the National Guard military redistributing stuff.
I mean, that's how it started. But then, like, yeah, the second time the National Guard shows up, people are like trying to run over the, like, take over the truck. And
yeah,
I feel like we had 1 week where it was like how humanity should behave. And then after that, it was a downward spiral into anarchy.
It definitely disintegrated. But
it is interesting because one of the things, I mean, I feel like it was bleak, but also still very insulated because our perspective was always from Jacob's perspective. Mm-hmm. So everything from the English world was very diluted. Like, we weren't having chapters that were interspersed of like 8 million people die in this city due to some horrible thing that, you know, some whatever, mm-hmm. or, you know, this blah, blah, blah. You're not getting that kind of overload of stuff that would have been if you were more like, this was a report from the English perspective as opposed to the Amish. So I feel like in some ways that softened it a little bit, but it was definitely, I don't know, I guess, I don't necessarily think of myself as a pessimist, but I guess I thought it was bleak, but I didn't necessarily think it was totally unrealistic.
I'm not sure it is either, but it was definitely bleak.
That's true. Maybe it can be both. It can be realistic and bleak.
Bleak, but not hopeless? Or understandably bleak.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Because it's like, I don't know, none of us know what would happen. I just feel like, I mean, this could happen. Humans can be terrible.
Well, I feel like the other thing that was, they did a good job of portraying was, it wasn't that everybody resorted to anarchy. Like, it was seemed clear that, like, there were good people still trying to do good things. But when when you're starving and you're being told by these, you know, some outside force, oh yeah, we're going to bring food, and like, mm-hmm. but like, you don't have supplies and you don't have access to anything, you know, that's a really hard place to be at. And there was that character of Doug, basically he's a hitchhiker and Jacob finds him or something or along the street and has some kind of conversation with him. And Doug is basically just like, do you have any food? It's not that everybody is evil. There are people mm-hmm. who are desperate. And even the people who did these, who, you know, killed the other Amish family and tried to kill Jacob's family, they also very much differentiate. There's two attackers. One is very much portrayed as like, this is someone who probably was not a very good person prior to this event and mm-hmm. is just made worse. And the other one is very much portrayed as like, that's someone who just is very hungry and with the wrong people. And so, I don't know, I feel like there was empathy for the fact that even good people struggle to make good choices when you're hungry, you know, like, to be frank. The other thing I did want to just say, Aaron, your comment about why would they go to Ohio? I don't know. One thing I was thinking about is the density of the East Coast is sometimes hard to fully understand. How many That's people, true. Like New York, Philadelphia, like, I mean, these are essentially just one basically connected metropolitan area. And so there is, I think, a difference in density if you're close to that versus, I know there are cities in Ohio, but it's just the density is much different. So if you could find a place to be further away from that, and a lot of those people are going to die. So if you just get a little further away, time will, like, the winter will pass and then there will be drastically fewer people there.
Now I'm envisioning this like strange convergence where all like Eastern state Amish and Mennonites migrate to the Midwest and Ohio just becomes an entire like nation state of Amish people who have
the Amish state
who have like all been like, yep, time to pull back and reassess. Everyone huddle up. Mm-hmm. We're gonna, mm-hmm. gonna hang out here.
Yeah. I will just say, in terms of the ending, I feel like it worked internally, in terms of Jacob's perspective, but I definitely was left being like, I want to keep going on this journey. I wasn't done with this journey. Like, I could kind of see where the author had to put a cap on it and chose this method to do it, but I was not I would read part two of this, mm-hmm. I would happily read the next volume of this diary, but it's also more my jam. I do like the post-apocalyptic stuff, even not YA. So for our final thing, let's just talk about, are there any other themes or interesting lines that you wanted to discuss?
Yeah, I noticed kind of early on that Jacob was aware of how he and his community were attached to the English. And he was aware of the benefits and drawbacks of that and the reason that he was. But there's a point where it kind of comes to a head where he says, we know now that as the world of the English fails around us, we are not separate. We have the order, and yes, we have our way, but the time when that meant that we stood free from the world has passed. I am not sure, as I think about it now, that that has ever really been true. We were never truly apart, as much as we chose to set ourselves different from the world that surrounds us. So, you know, he says essentially this is the same rain falling on everybody, and we're pretty separate, but we're not separate.
Yeah.
You know, and he doesn't necessarily come to conclusions about this is good or this is bad, just that it situates him in the world. I thought it was an interesting observation.
Yeah, I agree. So for ratings for this, let's go with 1 to 5 Falling Angels, which I don't know if we actually clarified, but the Falling Angels are essentially it's the Aurora Borealis then that comes and creates these waves of pulsing light, which apparently look like angels. So Tilly, well, how would you rate this? 1 to 5 Falling Angels.
I think I'd give it a 4.5. I think the 0.5 gets knocked off because there are some kind of disjointed bits. But for the most part, anything that seemed a little off to me was very much explained by the fact that we had one narrator in a trying time in like a 2-3 month period. Mm-hmm. And Hume is the unreliable narrator, or the not entirely unbiased narrator, maybe is a better descriptor of mm-hmm. what Jacob is. I liked the prose. I liked the story. I thought that it felt real and heartfelt. I liked it.
Yeah. Nice. How about you, Aaron?
I don't know how to rate this book at all, because while I can understand it was a good book and better than most of the books we read, I didn't like it because I found it far too depressing. Mm-hmm. And if there was a second mm-hmm. piece of this book, I would maybe pick it up to read the first 4 chapters just to know if they made it to Ohio, and then I would be done. Or maybe I would have one of the two of you read it and then tell me what happened. So I'm going to put this as a 3, because did I personally like it? No, but it was well written. It was an interesting premise. It's just not a genre. Like, if I'm going to read this genre, I really do want it to be the YA, so that I, when I get to the end, I feel hopeful instead of sad. If any of our listeners want to guess my Enneagram type based on that review, that might be perfectly possible.
Well, this is interesting. I don't know what this says about my Enneagram type, but I also really liked this. And this was, I think I'm going to go with a 4.5 as well. I think I would echo a lot of what you said, Tilly. I felt like it was well written, and it dealt with real issues, and it felt realistic in the way that it portrayed the ways that Amish would interact in this type of situation. I thought the writing was good. It was also a, like, engaging read. I didn't struggle to get through it. I was, like I kind of said, I would have been happy to read part two. I'm guessing that isn't ever going to happen, seeing as this is, you know, been out now for 6 years. So I don't think there's a part two coming. But it is interesting because I definitely, and I do read in the, like, post-apocalyptic genre, but part of it is, like, what draws me to it is not the depressing, bleak stuff, but the hopeful stuff. And this book was bleak, but I think for me, I didn't find it devoid of hope. Like, bad things happen, but the Amish community was still coming together. They were able to make good choices as a community. And even, like, their English neighbors, while might not necessarily agree with them essentially laying down martial law to defend their Amish neighbors, they were also like, this bad thing happened to you and we're going to, like, we're going to step in and help. You know, we might not agree with the way in which they did it, but there was, I don't know, I guess I found, I didn't see it as devoid of hope. And partly, I think, some ways, the way that it was portrayed, like, when Sadie talked about it, too, it was like, this is our struggle, not this is our doom. And again, I think in some ways I found it more helpful because this was from the Amish perspective. I think this would have been told from, like, an English person living in Philadelphia. This would have been a short, bleak book. Like, so I think that's also part of what made it feel like I could envision that, like, you know, are Jacob and his family going to live to get to Ohio? I don't know. But, like,
yes, they are. They better.
They will. Excellent. Oh. They will. There we go.
That's why there's no sequel, though, Tilly, because Jacob wasn't alive to write it.
Yeah, that's right.
I left it more as, like, humanity will figure out a way to get past this. It will be horrible for many people, but that there will be forward progress. So, I don't know. Yeah, well, this is an interesting read.
As you were saying this, I think this is helping me clarify part of why I felt that it was a hopeful book, even though there were some really bleak moments. And I think it kind of ties into how often we've seen Amish principles discarded as soon as the going gets tough because they're inconvenient. Mm-hmm. And this is a intense scenario of real testing. And they keep to their principles. They don't discard mm-hmm. them because it's inconvenient. Mm-hmm. They don't discard them because they believe it. And mm-hmm. I imagine that, you know, along their migration, maybe they will lose people along the way who decide that they would rather, you know, fight off people, or they're willing to work with the English in a way that makes them more complicit with violence. You know, like, I could see that not everyone is going to stick to it in the same way, but as a community, they are orienting themselves in that direction. And that feels very true to history. And that feels nice to see. Mm-hmm. When I feel like a lot of post-apocalyptic novels or just novels that confront war and disaster, they always take that gritty look where it's just like, this is terrible and we will all become worse people. We'll live through it, but we'll be worse for it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, they're not going to be happier for it, but, like, they're not going to become worse human beings either. And mm-hmm. that's nice to think about.
Mm-hmm. True. I mean, yeah. That they made the choice to leave does help. Like, if they had chosen to stay, mm-hmm. that would have felt much more dark and depressing than mm-hmm. choosing to leave.
Yeah.
I don't know. You can persuade me there's more hope in it than maybe
I won't try to persuade you. I think your take on it is perfectly valid. It was just mine. What's different? Yeah. Well, thank you for listening to this week's episode on When the English Fall by David Williams. We'd love to hear your thoughts on post-apocalyptic novels, survivalist prepping, as well as your recommendations, corrections, and other musings. Next week, we will be interviewing Carrie Neitz, the author of Amish Vampires in Space. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram at Plain Wrong Pod, or email us at plainwrongpod@gmail.com. And if you'd like to help support the podcast financially, we have merch for sale at TeePublic and a Patreon that you can join. And we also always appreciate when people leave reviews and subscribe, as that is how other people learn this podcast exists. Thanks for tuning in.